Hello and welcome to Film Weekly. I'm Zan Brooks, filling in for Jason Solomons, who's preparing for his new role as the proud father of a newborn babe. On this week's show, we'll be previewing The End of the World as We Know It with Franny Armstrong, director of the ingenious eco-drama documentary The Age of Stupid. And we'll be quizzing comedy duo James Corden and Matthew Horn about their move to the big screen with Lesbian Vampire Killers. I'll also be joined in the studio by Guardian film critic Peter Bradshaw, who will be running us through the week's big releases. These include Il Divo, Duplicity, and the hilarity that is Paul Blart Mole Cop. You might just die laughing. And come to think of it, that might not be such a bad way to go, because it turns out that the planet is doomed and we're all headed for the scrap heap anyway. This, at least, is the message of the Age of Stupid, which plays out in the year 2055. The ice caps have melted and London is underwater. Holed up in his base in the Arctic, Pete Postlethwaite pores over archive newsreel footage from the age of cheap flights and Hurricane Katrina and wonders just where it all went wrong.
It's like looking through binoculars, observing people on a far-off beach, running around in circles, fixated on the small area of sand under their feet as a tsunami races towards the shore.
101 degrees Fahrenheit. It's the hottest day ever recorded.
Of course, worried about global warming. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean...
Well, the process balloon is now going up phone box.
The question I've been asking is, why didn't we save ourselves when we had the chance?
Now, Age of Stupid is a film that kind of defies easy classification. You could watch it as a sci-fi drama, or you could watch it as a public service documentary. Earlier, I spoke to director Franny Armstrong, and I asked her just what she was trying to make.
Well, originally, way back in 2002, the idea was to pinch the structure of Steven Soderbergh's film Traffic, which I'm sure you've seen, but it's a really great structure because it fits interweaving human narratives. It's just a great way of addressing a complicated international issue where it's no black and white, it's no good guys, bad guys. Mm. In his case, the drugs trade, but in our case, oil and climate change.
I mean, were you wanting to do something very different from, you know, the other successful documentaries on this subject? You know, I'm thinking of like A Crude Awakening or An Inconvenient Truth.
Well, obviously, when we started, neither of those films had come out, so I wasn't being influenced by them at all. But I actually am very, very happy about Inconvenient Truth, not just because it's a brilliant film and it's done very well at awakening the public to the upcoming climate crisis, but from our selfish point of view, it so brilliantly did the science background.
Yeah.
That we're kind of assuming that everybody's seen that, and it meant that we didn't have to do any of that in our film, which is great. So ours just focuses on the human and the kind of moral aspects of climate change.
So just to kind of lead us through it, the film is set 50 years, sort of 50-odd years from now, and it's looking back at now, where we are today.
Yeah, it's set in the version of the future where we fail to act now, and then that, which would mean that people then at that time will be... in the time of runaway climate change, and there'll be nothing they can do to stop it then, because now we're in the very last period, kind of about 5 to 10 years left when we can still act to stop it. So those people in the future are looking back at us saying, you know, why were they so stupid?
And how did Pete Postlethwaite get involved in the project?
Well, we finished the 6 interweaving documentaries about 2 years ago or something now, and watched it, and I basically just thought, you know, that it wasn't really good enough. I just didn't like my own film, which is a terrifying moment, you know. But after a couple of months of soul-searching, we decided to add this drama element.
Right.
The idea of it being an older actor came first, and then as soon as, you know, within 10 seconds of it, of us thinking, let's make it an older actor, then I was like, Pete Postlethwaite and nobody else, you know, just because he's literally my favourite actor. But he was totally out of our league, obviously. Mm. I mean, we're nobodies, and he's an Oscar-nominated and all that. But we literally just Googled him, just on the off chance that he happened to be really into climate change. And the first article that came up was his local paper saying that he was trying to get permission for a wind turbine on his land.
That's right,
and,
yeah.
There was a lovely quote from him that said something like, it's everybody's responsibility to do everything they can about climate change. And when I read that, that was a real moment for me, you know, because I just thought, oh my God, Pete Postlethwaite might say yes.
Yeah, I mean, this film covers a lot of ground, and there's a sort of various different narratives running through the film. So we've got the displaced refugees from Iraq. We've got the young whiz kid entrepreneur who's running this sort of cheap flights airline. Why did you take those decisions to sort of follow those stories through?
Well, we were basically looking for six humans around the world, all different ages, all different countries, each with a really interesting narrative in their own right, like trying to set up an airline or trying to become a doctor or whatever. But we were looking for people who did have contradictions. We didn't want to just have, you know, good guys and bad guys. We wanted real people. There's so much energy amongst everybody who's working on this now. And enthusiasm and a, come on, this is our moment, let's do it. You know, let's define our generation as not stupid.
And by implication, that seems to be that you're suggesting that films can change the world, which is a sort of, that's a view that people kind of tend to shy away from.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very much doing this because I genuinely believe that not only can films change the world, but they're one of the most powerful ways of changing the world. Because, you know, somebody like me with no money, a little bit of experience, but, you know, no corporation backing me or anything. You know, I can make this film, get the money from a load of investors, and then potentially get it out to hundreds of millions of people and potentially inspire them to pressurize the governments and change, get the right deal in Copenhagen. I mean, it's an enormously powerful tool.
Good luck with all of that. And
thanks
saving
so much.
The world and all that jazz.
We'll do our best.
Franny Armstrong talking to me there. An Age of Stupid is on general release this week. Joining me now in the studio is Guardian film critic Peter Bradshaw. Peter, what did you make of The Age of Stupid?
I thought it was kind of engaging. It's kind of very ragged and scrappy. It has a kind of, and I don't mean this to sound like an insult, a kind of very young feel to it.
In that
it has a kind of naivety in a way, and it's very much addressed to a younger audience. It looks like it's an activist documentary. It's addressed to the young people who would, as it were, make up a kind of demonstration or whatever.
Yeah.
It's also the kind of documentary that very much winds up the kind of media commentariat who are used to a much more consensual, sophisticated documentary, and they get and I predict that lots of them on the left and the right will become very irritated by being sort of jabbed in the stomach and told not to take Ryanair flights anymore to their Tuscan villas, etc., etc., etc. I liked it. I suspect it will get condescended to like mad in exactly the way that Michael Moore used to. People forget now that when Michael Moore released Fahrenheit 9-1-1, it was outrageous. There were lots of people on the kind of supercilious middle ground who looked down their nose at him before deciding that they agreed with him all along. And I suspect there's going to be a little touch of that in the approach to Franny Armstrong. It's not ideal, it's not brilliant, it's not even particularly original, but it's got a kind of, it packs a punch, actually. It's rough and ready, but I liked it for that.
So that's a thumbs up for The Age of Stupid from Peter there. Let's move on to an altogether different film. Duplicity
yes.
is the second feature from Tony Gilroy, who directed the Oscar-winning Michael Clayton and wrote the scripts for the Bourne outings.
Yes.
This is a tale of romance and rivalry in a world of corporate wheeler-dealing. Julia Roberts and Clive Owen play former secret agents who are now plying their trade as industrial spies. They're on the trail of a secret hair care product, in fact, which may be worth billions to the cosmetics giants. But this is a film in which nobody can quite be trusted and nothing is as it seems.
Remember me? This wasn't an accident, was it? Being here, meeting like this.
Can you imagine living like this? How much do you think you'd need?
20 million?
I was thinking 40.
So what do you have to do to get $40 million?
I took a job in counterintelligence for Brick and Randall. They're about to make a move. Some new product. Something big.
The very existence of this product must be carefully protected.
My God, he is gonna crush me.
It's a total corporate death match. The competition will do anything to get their hands on this.
Guess who they like for director of Intel Operations?
You on one side, me on the other. It's perfect.
You know what I think?
I think you like the idea.
Peter, Tony Gilroy's last film was also a tale of kind of corporate mismanagement
yes.
and shady backroom deals, Michael Clayton. But the tone of this
yes.
is very different, isn't it?
It's very different. It's almost a kind of blast from the past. It's the kind of romantic caper that they used to make in the late 60s. When I watched this, I suddenly remembered that ages ago I watched a Doris Day movie made in 1967, which has a very similar plot. It's called Caprice. Directed by Frank Tashlin.
I haven't seen Caprice.
It's very,
maybe he's banking on the fact that you're the only person who's seen Caprice.
It is very similar in some ways. It has an old-fashioned kind of 60s, 70s yeah. kind of caperish feel to it. Actually, not even 70s, maybe sort of 50s, 60s.
Well, it's a little bit like kind of charade at times as well, exactly. The old kind of like Cary Grant.
Yes. Film. And I like that in some ways. I like the fact that it's sort of cerebral. It asks, it makes more intellectual demands in a way with its kind of double cross, quadruple cross, triple cross. We have to backspace, you know, we go back 14 months to find out why people are behaving in the way they are. I wanted to like it because I think it's slickly made, but my main problem is I just didn't believe that Clive Owen and Julia Roberts had any sort of relationship at all. The idea that they were that they might have a relationship and then be so in love with money that they might imperil that relationship either with themselves or with each other or whatever. I mean, I didn't even get the impression that they fancied each other all that much, to be honest with you. It's one of those experiences that you sometimes have watching a film is that you can imagine the two megastars at the end of the day quitting and going back to their respective trailers and then never talking to each other ever again. Yeah. Having a perfectly warm professional relationship with each other, but, you know, not going out for dinner in the evening, not going out for drinks in the hotel bar while they're on location, nothing like that at all. And that's sort of what I felt. And I'm a fan of Julia Roberts, actually. Usually, I really like Julia Roberts, but I thought she was, there was something pinched and rather kind of closed about her performance here, really, to be honest with you.
What do you think of Clive Owen? I mean, I always wonder if he's all there.
I know what you mean. He has a kind of manner and a style. I think sometimes that works with a more serious role, that what he appears to be withholding, intensely withholding, clenching within his intestines, some terrible secrets, worked better with the recent thriller, The International.
Yeah.
This one, he's got to give a lot more.
Yeah.
And he sort of doesn't.
He can't.
He looks the role. He looks like $1 million. And as I say, it's a great showreel opportunity for if and when Daniel Craig decides to pull the plug and we'll hand over the 007 tux to somebody else. I think Clive Owen is still in pole position for it. And it certainly keeps his hand in with this sort of material. It keeps the public thinking of him in this sort of role. And I think there's no reason why he couldn't, as it were, play David Tennant to Daniel Craig's Christopher Eccleston and take over the big job. But yes, there is something, well, they say that the definition of a star is that you've got something missing rather than something extra. Mm. And sometimes Clive, possibly in this role, is a little bit too much missing.
He takes that into kind of negative space, doesn't he?
He does take that formula. I just think some of the time, when he was doing those dialogue scenes with Julia Roberts, was she even in the room with him?
Yeah.
I mean, when they cut in the single shots of him, did they have to have some second AD standing in Julia Roberts' place? And did some the same second AD have to stand in while Julia Roberts did her kind of sort of pouting, narrow-eyed look of, well, what's it supposed to denote? Suspicion, kind of suppressed rage, suppressed lust. I don't know. But I don't know. I think Julia Roberts is in a bit of a weird place in her career right now. I think she's looking for a more interesting role. She sort of could have had it with Charlie Wilson's War, but I don't think did in the end. I think it's, in a way, it's the industry's fault. They're not writing interesting roles for performance who are heavy hitters. I mean, Julia Roberts is a heavy hitter.
But she's in that awful kind of limbo land where she's just a bit too old in Hollywood terms to play the love interest and not quite old enough to play, you know, the lovable mum.
She's too young for Sunset Boulevard, but too old for Pretty Woman.
Let's move on to Paul Blart, Mall Cop, which I guess, you know, you're tipping Clive Owen as the next Bond after Daniel Craig. But perhaps, you know, it could be Kevin James, who is the star of this film, who plays a schlubbish security guard who really wanted to be a police officer. He's the sort of loser who wants to be a hero.
He's always been dedicated.
Paul Blart, Mall Cop.
To protecting...
We got a high roller.
The West Orange Pavilion Mall.
I'm afraid I'm going to have to issue a citation.
Can you validate this?
Sir? Sir, I'm warning you, sir.
Oh, stop.
Sir, you're a nasty old man.
Kevin James is one of these actors that you will have seen in dozens of movies without realizing it. He's been in loads, particularly Adam Sandler.
I think that's the only films that I know him from. But
he was in there. He played opposite. He had a pretty big showcase in the Will Smith comedy Hitch. I don't know if you remember that as his kind of supportive.
I seem to remember you hating that film.
I did hate it. Like, I don't know. I'm not a big fan of Kevin James, really. I'm going to be honest. I thought Paul Blart had a few laughs in it. It had some laughs in it. I didn't mind it. But it's got that weird Adam Sandler's insistence that actually, however pathetic the lead character is, he's also got to be taken seriously as a hero. You can't laugh at him all the time. In fact, you can't even laugh at him any of the time. I've written about this. What happens in the opening scene is you see him failing the physical for the New Jersey Police Academy, if such a thing really exists. I suspect that it doesn't quite in that. And it shows him actually doing it really well. He's not running out. He's not losing his breath. He's not pathetic. He's keeping up with the guys very well indeed.
He's not comedy fat boy.
He's not comedy fat. No, in no way. He does a kind of spectacular sort of loop-the-loop jump. The only reason he fails it is because he's got this hyperglycemia, which makes him suddenly fall asleep. And it's a way of saying, look, don't laugh at our guy, you know. He's not a loser. I mean, okay, he's a bit chunky and people laugh at him, but he's not to be laughed at. In fact, he's a bit of a tough guy. And this opening scene is so unconvincing. I was convinced that it had to be a dream sequence. You know, surely this is his pathetic longing is going to be revealed to be a dream. But no. Oh, no. He's the real thing. Paul Blart is a massive US box office success. It may do for him what 40-year-old Virgin did for Steve Carroll. It might put him onto the A-list. But there's something, again, it's a Clive Owen thing. There's something missing in Kevin James's personality. I don't know. There's something about him. I don't find it winning. I really don't find him winning. There's something about him. It's just me, I guess.
Yeah, I think so, because this film has done phenomenally
well.
So there is an appetite for the fat boys who should be taken seriously.
Yeah, and who take themselves inside. They take themselves very seriously.
And it goes a bit kind of Die Hard towards the end, doesn't
it? It's very Die Hard. It is more or less based on Die Hard. Again, the weird, something weirdly serious and almost humorless happens when he has to take on the kind of terrorist attackers of the mall. His ridiculous Segway personal transporter, this upright kind of pogo stick that he whizzes around in. The joke, until the serious moments come in, the joke was that this travels really slowly. And yet, for some reason, in a crisis, it seems to be able to outrun the fastest and most fanatically dedicated villain. And it's never quite explained how this can be, but he seems to be able to do it.
OK, Peter, that's Paul Blart, Mall Cop, which has maybe two or three laughs. The ratio, perhaps not quite worth our while.
Not quite, but maybe DVD.
Should we do a good film now?
Yeah.
All right, let's do a good one. I mean, for my money, the best film of the week is Il Divo, which is Paolo Sorrentino's fractured, exotic portrait of the three-time Italian Prime Minister Giulio Andreotti. Like me, we probably saw Il Divo first in Cannes last year, where it won the second prize, didn't it?
It's a wonderful film, I think. Sorrentino's films, I've been captured by, since I first saw his first feature, which is The Consequences of Love, again starring his repertory leading man, Tony Servillo. There are very few films and very few filmmakers of whom you say, this really doesn't look like anything I've ever seen before. His style, which is stylized, angular, theatrical in a way, and mask-like. There's something so bizarre and mesmeric and stylized about Sorrentino's films. And this could be his masterpiece because it just looks like something beamed in from outer space almost.
Yeah.
It just looks like, it looks as if it hasn't been influenced by anything at all. It has been. I mean, there are signs, of course, that he has cautiously ingested some visual touches from the Americans, from Scorsese and Tarantino, actually, with his very showy, kinetic, and very sexy montage set pieces showing true life people being whacked in various positions, in various circumstances.
Mi rivolgo allo Stato, mi rivolgo agli inquirenti, io vi chiedo di identificare e di castigare esemplarmente tanto gli esecutori come i mandanti, perché anche questa volta essi non rimangano, specialmente i mandanti, in uno scontro.
There is very little what you might call affect in his films. He absolutely refuses to make you sympathise with anybody.
Yeah.
Even the slightly emollient moments where Andreotti seems to have moments of intimacy with his wife, his long-standing wife of 40, 50 years, even these are inflected with a strange kind of acrid irony, and you're never allowed to dwell on anything. It just moves along at such a clip, and it's bewildering. You can't possibly keep pace with all these players, all these true life politicians.
Yeah, I really kind of struggled to keep up with it at times. Another problem for me, and it's not necessarily even a kind of bad thing, is that you've got this kind of void at the centre, haven't you?
Yeah.
And, you know, this is a man who is the ultimate kind of Machiavellian survivor.
Yes.
But nothing's quite stuck to him. And he's still alive. He's still sitting in Parliament.
He has a life senatorial job. He's 90 years old now. He was arraigned on mafia charges and implausibly acquitted of them. And that's what's kind of more or less inoculated him against any further political scandal. That, of course, and his grey hairs, and, of course, the massive vested interest that every single part of the Italian political and media establishment has in just simply not investigating it any further. And that's part of what Sorrentino's talking about. And he's very angry about the extraordinary corruption and complacency at the very top of Italian public life, which is carried on for decades. And he's authentically angry about it. He's an idealist and a satirist. And he's saying, look, you know, we've all been complicit in this.
It's the sort of fog of evil, isn't it? That you kind of wander in and you feel it kind of damp against your skin, but you can't quite work out where you are.
I've said this is one of those few films in our secular age which has a sense of sin. A real sense that Andreotti says that I have sinned, but I've taken this sin onto myself because I believe that this is the only way to make... He's convinced himself this is the only way Italy itself will survive. I know that I've done evil things, or that I have enabled evil things to be done, or looked the other way while brutal southern Italian politicians and mobsters have done things which are politically expedient for me. But that is necessary for Italia itself. And that's... it's sort of compelling. It's not an easy watch, and it's not for everybody. And I'm not even sure, I'm not even sure that I like it, in a sense that I don't enjoy it. It's like a kind of bizarre
experience.
You can't warm to it. There's something so dry and scorched, and acrid and arid about its satire. But it is a fascinating film in many ways.
Well, for a really brilliant kind of exploration of the Stygian tangled rat's nest of Italian politics. That's Paolo Sorrentino's Il Divo, which is on release from this week. Peter, thanks so much for joining me
in the studio.
It's wonderful to have you here as ever. And you can read all of Peter's reviews by visiting guardian.co.uk/film. Now, what's the deal with TV comedy double acts? No sooner have they hit the jackpot on the small screen than they're trying their luck on the big. We've had Pete and Dud, Morecambe and Wise, Smith and Jones and Mitchell and Webb, and now James Corden and Matthew Horne are doing it too. The first film from the likeable Gavin and Stacey duo is Lesbian Vampire Killers, in which our heroes play ramblers in the woods who stumble across something altogether horrible, but, you know, sort of sexy too.
I got a plan. Does it involve girls? Let's go hiking.
What? It's one of the most depressingly shitty ideas for a holiday I've ever heard in my life, ever.
Country air. Nothing like it.
Smells like normal air with cow shit in it.
What are the chances?
These girls are all going to the exact same cottage that we are!
What was that?
Vampires.
Vampires? Vampires?
Lesbian vampires.
Nice one.
Before he dashed for the maternity ward, Jason Solomons caught up with Gavin and Smithy, aka James and Matthew, to ask them about the potential pitfalls of adapting a tried and tested screen persona to the deeper waters of the comedy feature.
For James and I, it's good to do a variety of work for us as performers and for an audience as well. You know, if we'd have done Gavin and Smithy Go on Holiday, we'd have been utterly lambasted
for
it.
There was a bit where you said you were going to Ibiza, and I thought, I thought that at the beginning of the film you were going to go to Ibiza, in which case, you know, that's Kevin and Perry did that.
Yeah. No, the script is... the script, I think, is original and fresh and funny, and that's what really attracted us to it.
Yeah. How much of it were you able to work on yourself? Because obviously, Gavin and Stacey, you're probably in charge of your own destinies very much in terms of the characters and the writing on that. Were you able to input on this?
The truth is, we didn't really need to. It was such a tight script, but, you know, there was moments where...
It says bell end in the script.
Yeah, truly. it's a really tight script. Honestly, it did. And there were little moments where... Phil, the director, we would do a scene, and then he'd go, okay, we've got that. Now do one and just do what you want. Take it wherever you want. And we'd sort of riff around it and improvise. And some of those bits have made it to the film and some of them, rightly so, ended up on the cutting room floor, you know?
Yeah. Because, I mean, it is. There are fewer. I may say this. It's not Shakespeare, but there are a few actors who could deliver the word bellend with such relish these days as you, James.
Oh, I take that as a huge compliment. I know that I'm, you know, when it comes to any kind of mention of, you know, bellends, helmets, anything, that I'm up there with the best. And you know,
but for James, it always comes from a place of truth.
Yeah,
you've seen them. You've got one.
I've seen one. I've seen them. I've got one. I'm aware of them.
You've seen good ones, bad ones.
Yeah, I've been around them. I've spent time with them, and I had to research a lot. So I did look at a lot of bellends and spend time with a lot of bellends. I spent a lot of time with Dominic Cooper, who, as if people have seen Mamma Mia, is one of the finest bellends in the country, and that's what we did.
Yeah. You know. Good. I was thinking how we're going to bring Dominic in.
The reason why that is so funny is because he really is
a bellend.
He's a bellend,
but he's a beautiful bellend.
He's a beautiful bellend. Yeah,
he's a great bellend.
But I was watching the Oscars. Who was on the red carpet? Don't think either of you two were. Dominic Cooper was.
Okay. I got two BAFTAs, so you can really say whatever you want. It doesn't, you know, you can go to the Oscars all you want.
No offence, this film won't be troubling the Academy, I don't think, anytime soon.
I'd be amazed if it was. I'd be amazed if it was.
Troubling the Academy.
Troubling the Academy. Yeah, I think you can tell by its release date that we're not planning this to be a big award season push. Yeah. You know?
Just before Cannes as well,
yeah,
I noticed.
Yeah.
When you are doing something like this, though, you obviously are tapping into, I suppose, a great British tradition in that, you know, the kind of small screen to big screen transfer. I know you're not a double act. It's not Cannon and Ball. But you can't sort of get away from the fact that it is one of those kind of terribly British affairs. It is that there's a lot of carry on. There's a lot of boobs in
it's
it.
It's a very British movie, yeah. And I think that's a real positive in the film. It's full of campery and tongue in cheek winks here and there.
And you're doing Joe Orton at the moment.
I am doing Joe Orton. Yeah.
As if enough sauce.
It's all wonderful, dear.
Oh no.
Are you a bit worried about that journey? I mean, because I do think that Gavin Stacey is a genius piece of work, and I'm not going to lie to you. I don't think Lesbian Vampire is quite on the level of genius, if I may say. But it is very interesting in your careers, because I do think, you know, that people will go and see it as well. Is it at your stages of career? Do you think about the kind of commercial side of things, the audience side of things?
I think you have to a bit, of course, because what's the point of doing work if no one's going to see it? You want your work to be viewed by people. Otherwise, it's kind of pointless. You know, you can make a film and just play it in your own living room. That would be crazy. You of course want people to see your work and like it, and that's why, you know, I really think this is a good script. It's a teen horror, you know, buddy movie, and that's what it is, you know, in the same way that I don't think Superbad is as good as Slumdog Millionaire, but they still both have a place.
Congratulations on Lesbian Vampire
Thank
Killers,
you
boys,
ever so much.
And hanging out with loads of busty girls for 6-7 weeks must have been quite fun.
It was the whole thing was great fun.
Yeah, brilliant.
Thanks for coming on Film Weekly.
James Corden and Matthew Horne talking to Jason Solomons. And that just about brings the curtain down on this week's show. We've had the Armageddon, we've had vampires, the mafia, and an off-screen baby too. All that remains is to thank the cast. So thanks to Franny Armstrong and Peter Bradshaw, to James Corden and to Matthew Horne. A huge thanks to my producer, Sarah Peters, and a final thank you to you for listening. I'm Zan Brooks, and this was Film Weekly.